I lied. I cheated. I bribed men to cover the crimes of other men. I am an accessory to murder. And if I had to do it all again, I would. A guilty conscience is a small price to pay for the safety of the Alpha Quadrant. I'm Eddie Webb.
And I'm Chris Spivey.
And today we're talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine on Genreless. Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Genreless, and I'm excited about this one because this is one that I know Chris and I both have very strong feelings about, which is Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Which is still the best Trek, in my humble opinion.
I agree with you. There was a point where, so my history was, I mean, I grew up on the original series. My mom was a big fan of the original series. We watched it in reruns. Then when Next Generation started airing, my mom and I watched that every week. So for years, Next Gen was like, this is the best Trek. And I watched a little bit of Deep Space Nine around the time I watched Babylon 5, actually, and both had the same problem for me. It's like, I missed a few episodes. I mean, I don't know what's happening. So I just stopped watching. But then I watched it like 5 or 6 years ago. I think it's actually 10 years now. Because it was a DVD box set. That's why I remember. And they're like, you have to watch this. I'm like, all right, fine. And yeah, now it is the best Trek. I 100% hands down, I think it is one of the best Star Treks. And it's funny because, like, until recently, it was also the most non-Star Trek-like Star Trek show. I mean, now that Discovery exists, obviously there's a lot more room to interpret what Star Trek is. But, I mean, Deep Space Nine was – everyone talks about the serialization, but, I mean, like, the character depth and the complexity and the fact that it really kind of put the lie to the utopic vision of the Federation, all this stuff. I really have always dug it. And you said this was your first Star Trek, right?
This is my first real Star Trek. Yeah. Like, I'd occasionally seen maybe one or two random episodes of the OG with my grandmother. I might have, like, passed through the room and she's like, this is science fiction. You like science fiction. Watch this with me. Mm-hmm. And I would go, I like science fiction. I'm not sure what this is that you're watching, but I can linger for 15 minutes and move on.
Right.
But that was the joys of youth.
It, true. True. So when did you actually watch Deep Space Nine first? Like, was on when it was on the air, or did you watch it later?
I actually started when it was in the air because I was also watching Babylon 5.
Right. Okay.
And so it was that I was caught in that debate that people were having between, oh my god, oh my goodness, this copied this show because they're both on space stations.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a pointless debate. You can have two different types of shows that occur in a similar environment because the stories that you're telling aren't going to be the same stories. So automatically they're different shows and you can engage with each one differently. And the characters themselves put a different conflict and spin on things.
And I mean, it's interesting. Since we just did Babylon 5, I do want to dig into Deep Space Nine directly, but I think it's worth kind of talking about that debate a little bit because it was such a thing in the 90s sci-fi society culture. And having watched both of them relatively recently now, I can see some points of comparison, but they're very different in a lot of ways. Like Deep Space Nine, everyone talks about how it is the serialized Star Trek, again, pre-Discovery. But watching it again, it's not nearly as serialized as Babylon 5 was at all. I mean, the last couple seasons are, but the first 4 or 5 are pretty episodic.
Oh, and, hands down.
And also, it didn't have the political, I mean, it had political intrigue, but it was much more wartime politics. I didn't have ambassadors. There was pretty much a couple, you know, there was the Bajorans, it was the Federation, and then everybody else.
But wasn't it for the first couple of seasons they were still trying to figure out what they wanted the show to be? Because I know that originally in Next Generation and the OG, they had like their ship and they just kind of travel from place to place and have one or two scuffles and leave. Mm-hmm. But for Deep Space Nine, you're sort of confined to a space. And they were trying something new, but I didn't think they fully had an understanding until maybe season 3, which is where it really started to come into its own.
Right. And that's worth kind of digging into the episodes because we've talked before about we originally were like, we'll do the pilot. Then we quickly found this new problem. And then I was like, we'll try early episodes. And then already with Deep Space Nine, I thought that's kind of hard to do because you're right. The first 2 seasons are not really Deep Space Nine that a lot of people are excited about. I've seen people go as far as to say, ignore all of season 1. I think that's too extreme. because there are some really good episodes in there. And Duet, I think, is one of them. That's one of the reasons why I picked Duet, because it's a really good case study of the complex relationships between Bajor and the Cardassians. And so for context for people who haven't seen the show, the basic premise is Deep Space Nine is actually a Cardassian space station that has been reclaimed by the Federation as the Bajorans make their bid to join the Federation. It is seen as a dead-end post. The Cardassians have withdrawn from their total subjugation of Bajor. And the Bajorans are basically trying to rebuild their site. They have a provisional government, so it's very early on. And the Cardassians just abandoned the station. The very first episode, they're basically rebuilding the station from scratch. And then they discover a wormhole, which leads to the Gamma Quadrant. And so Deep Space Nine suddenly becomes a very important strategic part of the Alpha Quadrant political landscape. And since it's – I've looked at a map about this recently – Cardassian Empire is actually on the border between the Alpha and Beta Quadrant. So it's a little bit of Beta Quadrant stuff that comes in as well. But suffice to say, the wormhole is a very long way, and then new people come in, and that's kind of the impetus of it. But you're right, it's the first season is a lot of, well, rather than having a ship go off to find weird shit will come through the wormhole and find them. Which does not work well. I mean, there are some that are okay episodes, but then there's episodes like Patient Zero for how bad season one is Move Along Home. Google it. Don't watch it, because not only is it a terrible episode about aliens that play games, but also the game design is actually very bad. So it makes me mad on multiple levels when I watch that episode.
I'm trying to remember now, since it's been a while since I've rewatched the entire series, but is that the one with Q?
No, Move Along Home is the one where the aliens come in, they go to
Quark's trapped in their bodies, bar, yeah.
Right, and then they get stuck in the actual game. No, the one with Q is, it does have Sisko punching Q, which is kind of funny, but also
something really Picard work
with Q or Sisko, yeah,
would never do. But I agree and disagree. That is a defining moment where they're trying to show you the difference between what Sisko would do and what Picard would do.
True, but it's very, and I think it's a good point to talk about, because Sisko does go through stages. Like, unlike a lot of the other Star Trek captains, Sisko does have a definitive character arc. And early Sisko is is an angry black man, right?
I'm gonna disagree.
Okay,
I'm gonna say that he is disenchanted with the situation that he's put in and the tragedy of the war that killed his wife, then being forced into a command that he didn't want. And then having the person that he blames for the death of his family come to tell him that he has to stay, basically, do it or get out, doesn't necessarily bode well to create a character that wants to be somewhere that's engaging. Because I'm going to say here and now, I think hands down that Sisko is, in the end, a better captain and leader than what Picard is.
I agree, especially because the one thing that I kind of went to the angry black man trope. I didn't mean to, because I feel like the writing kind of pigeonholes in that, but Avery Brooks pushes that way out of the way very fast. Like, a lot of that comes to the actor reading the lines, I think. And part of that is that Avery Brooks does a really good job of showing the trauma. Like, this is a traumatized character. Sisko, like you said, exactly. I mean, he went through a really rough, but he lost his wife. You know, he's got his son. He's in what he believes to be a shitty environment. And one of the things that the show picks up on later is the fact that this is a character who is struggling through grief. And it's not an easy process. It's not like one episode, he's like, well, cool, I'm over that now. I mean, it keeps coming back up. And I think it's good, because it's a very realistic view of how grief works and how trauma works. But is doing it through a 90s broadcast television lens, which doesn't always allow for nuance and subtlety. So sometimes it reads a bit flat, or it comes across a bit brusque. But and at least season one,
I think one of the reasons why you went for the trope is that it is a show that is still primarily written by a white focus group that is trying to portray a black character, and they unfortunately have fallen to, I'm going to assume, unconscious bias, and they're just grabbing things to try to do that. Mm-hmm. And then you have an exceptional actor who sees that, understands the role that they have and the things that they can do, and they're trying to bring some of their own lived experience to change and shape that into something better.
Right.
So you have people with good intentions, and then you have someone that's actually moving that forward.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a hallmark of the show as a whole, frankly, because when we talk about how the seasons get better over time, I think the writing starts to catch up to the actability, because this is a frankly stellar acting cast. And Duet is a really good example of that, because at the end of the whole episode is ultimately a Cardassian who is believed to be this mass murderer gets on station. He comes to station because he needs medical help. They discover that they believe him to be this actual mass murderer. He rejects it, eventually admits to it. And then they find out that he's actually was a file clerk of said mass murderer. And he has had a psychotic break. He now believes himself to be this horrible person.
Well, I don't even think that he believes himself to be it. He wants to try to bring some sort of resolution to these people that he feels guilt for, because he was on the planet and even talks about hearing all their screams and everything, and now he could never block it out. And he wants to try to like have his entire people come to them to ask for forgiveness. And he thinks this act of doing this is going to fulfill that. So he has the trauma of that situation coupled with his own service, doing something potentially he didn't want to do. We don't know for certain because that was never really established, but we know that the situation and how that impacted him as a character.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to view Kira trying to figure out what's really going on, putting aside her own like need for vengeance or justice for what happened to her people, to do what would be the correct and just thing. And like that conflict and struggle between them was beautiful to watch, and like the depth and ability of the actors to portray that, exceptional.
Right. And it's, I love Duet because also I have always felt that Star Trek works best when it's ultimately people in rooms talking to each other. And this is a perfect example of that, because really the entire episode is just that. It's people in different rooms talking to each other a lot. And that can be really bad if you have even mediocre actors. But the fact that all the actors really bring their game to it, and in this late season one, you know, we've been pretty firmly painting the Cardassians as the antagonists. The Nazi allegory is not subtle throughout Deep Space Nine. But this is, we start to see, okay, there are individuals in the Cardassian Union that maybe are more complicated than they come across as. They're not, I mean, they're all manipulative liars because that's what their society has trained them to become. But some of them have different personalities, to have different goals. Some of them have even noble goals, but they have to kind of cram it into this culture that doesn't allow them to express it. And then you have someone like Kira, who, again, during a war, things need to be very black and white. It's like, these are the people we need to kill. These are the people that we need to save. And she's having to kind of struggle with that post-war environment. Which is another thing that's really interesting with Deep Space Nine. The fact you could tell it's part of the 90s is that a main character is explicitly, repeatedly, and constantly referenced as a terrorist or a former terrorist. And that's something that just wouldn't fly, I think, these days.
Probably one of the things we should point out, though, about what Deep Space Nine that is so different for it than some of the other Star Trek shows, Sans Discovery, is that the main crew of the ship aren't all Starfleet.
True.
In fact, it is quite the opposite. You've got two or three Starfleet officers. You've got Kira, who's from Bajor, and so she's part of like their military. So she has allegiance to her own planet, and she's sort of serving as a first officer for Sisko. Then you've got Odo, who isn't really attached to any government, who's sort of like the security chief of the station.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have an array of other interesting characters like Quark and Garak, who are there, who sort of help in their own ways, but they aren't dedicated to Starfleet. They have their very own personal goals. And it was great to see a Starfleet individual try to interact with someone who is a civilian that they technically have to protect, that they know may not be doing what's best for Starfleet, but they could be doing what's best possibly for the station, for the people, possibly just for some gold-pressed platinum, depends on the day.
And that's one thing that you start to see in Duet, but you definitely see more in Improbable Cause and Dias Cast, is that the Starfleet officers, particularly Sisko, start to have to make decisions that are more letter of the law than spirit of the law, where he's making decisions that are best for the station and are best for what he believes to be the ideals of the Federation, but aren't necessarily a direct interpretation of the orders he should be giving in that moment. I believe it's in The Die Is Cast, where those two episodes, real quick, Garak, who is a tailor on station, he's a Cardassian tailor, and it has been believed since very early on that he is a spy. He has been working for a couple of seasons to build up a relationship with various Starfleet personnel, but primarily through Dr. Bashir. And Dr. Bashir is convinced he's a spy, but also Dr. Bashir is definitely portrayed as a naive character. And so a lot of people are like, oh yeah, whatever, he's just a tailor. In these episodes, we find out Bashir is completely right. Absolutely, Garak was a former spy. He has a chance to kind of come back in from the cold. And the cliffhanger of Improbable Cause is that Garak finally says, yes, I will rejoin my spy master and work for the Cardassians again. And what's interesting about that is that in traditional Star Trek, like when Picard becomes absorbed by the Borg, spoilers for Next Generation, but I think everyone knows the Locutus Twist by now. When that cliffhanger happens, it's like, okay, the question is, how does Picard get out of this? The question is not Picard is going to stay Borg forever, right? It's we know what's going to happen. We don't know if Garak's just going to stay a spy or not, because he's not Starfleet. He's not in that mold.
Can I say that I would have loved to have seen the version of Star Trek where Picard stays a Borg? That might have made me come and watch Next Generation to see what would have happened at that point.
That would be a lot. That would be a very brief war, I think. Cool, Starfleet's gone. And now what? Through this, there's kind of a B plot of the people at the station are like, you know, Garak's been abducted, he's gone, what do we do? And so, like, it's the everyone recognizes officially Garak is just a tailor and can leave whenever he wants to, and he's a Cardassian on top of it. So there's not going to be any official impetus from Federation, certainly not from Bajor, to track down this one Cardassian. So you see Kira and Sisko kind of dodging through the regulations to see if they can get in touch with Garak again. And it's through the lens of, well, Odo's also with him, so we have to go rescue Odo. So, of course, you know, Garak might just be a nice happy coincidence, but that's where the focus of it totally is all about Odo. And it's not really. And again, we see in the Die Is Cast that Garak actually does end up kind of going back, but it's, again,
but people talking rooms. You get his journey, though, through that, yeah. Because he gets a chance to go back to his spy master, who he's always felt some loyalty to, who might have been the person exiled him. It's sort of stated, but it's not stated. Mm-hmm. And the things the Spymaster is trying to get Garak to do, for instance, they want information from Odo to help with a raid they're going to do, and he puts Garak to torture Odo to find out the information that he needs. And this is a Garak that has been on this station with Odo for a number of years, and they may not be friends, but there's definitely some sort of connection from someone that you see on a daily basis in a very confined space. And you're watching him try to decide, like, do I really want this bad enough to potentially kill this person who is as close as I potentially have to a friend? And it comes down to the point where Garak even says, I don't care if you lie to me, tell me something that I can give to them to help you. And when Odo breaks down and tells him one of his own dark secrets, they didn't include in a Starfleet report or anything, that he refused to go back to his own people who became the antagonists of the show and instead chose to stay with Starfleet, but he wanted to go and he feels that call to still go to them. Mm-hmm. And Garak gets that information and he goes back to his own spymaster. And this is where you get to see at this point, Garak makes his decision, telling the spymaster that Odo didn't tell me anything, keeping Odo's secret.
Yep.
Like, that's good character work. And you see the complexity of that character in himself going through all those hoops and turns, realizing that even if we get away, I have to go back to pretending to be a tailor, to being a shadow of who I really am.
Right. And Quick digression, because I think at some point I would love to do some espionage talks with you. But one of the things I like about Deep Space Nine is that espionage is a huge theme throughout the show. It's not just – eventually the Cold War becomes hot and eventually they do have a full-on war. But throughout all of it, there's the espionage of the Cardassians with Bajor. The Bajorans even have some of their own espionage stuff. And then eventually – it turns out the Federation has not only Starfleet intelligence, but a secretive organization known as Section 31. So there's a lot of different takes on espionage. And this is very much kind of Le Carre style of espionage. It's much more about the psychological drain of having to constantly balance different loyalties and how to kind of navigate that through while keeping yourself intact. And we start to see that from Garak's perspective of the fact that he's definitely a spy. He definitely was banished from Cardassia. He still feels he wants to go home. That's something that is also a prevalent the character. He's homesick. He talks about Cardassian opera with Bashir and the like. He definitely wants to go back home. He can't. And yet he still makes decisions to protect people that he knows don't like him and don't trust him. So it's that very much, it's not action-packed. This isn't James Bond with gadgets. This is definitely just someone who knows when to lie at the right places and has to swallow what he's really feeling almost constantly. And these episodes, we start to see that seep through. And it's just, it's so engaging. It's so wonderful. Right. Garak is amazing.
I'm sorry, but I have to do this. So what you're telling us is that this is, in fact, Tinker Taylor Garak.
Yes!
Boom!
Yes,
my trust! Yes. I'll see myself out.
How did I miss that one? Oh, you're so good. But it is, right? And it's funny because, like, minor spoiler, but later on, another character does become more explicitly a James Bond analog. and how that happens is it's controversial, let's just say. But suffice to say, the show does play with the different flavors of espionage fiction. And this is definitely the deep psychological espionage stuff. And it's really, really good. And then the last one, normally I don't think we want to go. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Before we go into that, I will point out that for Garak is probably one of the most complex characters on the show. Mm-hmm. And I really wish they would have went ahead potentially from how much he interacts with Julian. There's like this sort of banter and repartee between the two that you could sense potentially that the writers might have been hinting at. There could have potentially been a Garak Julian relationship if they could have done that on 90s television.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's stated by them or anything, but it feels like it's almost implied just from the closeness those two characters achieve.
So what's interesting, actually, thank you for reminding me about this before we wrap up. The actor of Garak, Andrew J. Robinson, apparently because he wanted to make sure that the interior life of the character was consistent. He actually wrote in character diary of from Garak's perspective. As he got scripts, he would incorporate bits of data, and he wrote this ongoing diary of Garak's, which he eventually published as A Stitch in Time. So it's actually a Star Trek novel written by the actor who played Garak, all about Garak. And it's I have not read it yet, but I have heard so many people rave about it because it is definitely a look at his complex relationship with Cardassia, and also it goes all the way through to the end of the show, and I think just a little bit beyond. So it also talks to his relationships with people like Bashir and Sisko and the like. So I'm curious to see if there are more hints of it in there, because I agree there's definitely, if nothing else, they have a strong male friendship, which is equally rare to see on TV. But there definitely could have been some romantic comones there because he makes some decisions that are interesting with that context in mind.
And the thing is also, even if it was just a strong male friendship, it was a healthy strong male friendship.
Yes.
Built on like common interest and just enjoying each other's company.
Which again, I mean, it was one of those things that when it was pointed out to me that the relationship that Bashir has with most of his male colleagues is so different from most other male friendships on TV. And I started looking around, and I realized it's true. Because Bashir's relationship with the chief is also, it's very different. It's much more of a kind of rank classism relationship. The experienced master chief versus the naive officer. But that slowly evolves and changes and becomes interesting because also Bashir's single versus the chief's being a family man and whatnot. So, but again, it's a strong male friendship that it's not toxic at all, which is so refreshing, honestly. The last one I want to talk about, like I said, we mentioned this in the Babylon 5 episode. We don't want to go too deep, and season 6 is deep in the meta plot. Deep in the meta plot. But this episode, you're able to kind of pluck out. There's a couple of minor references that are pretty minor spoilers for the status quo of the time. But otherwise, you can watch this in isolation. I think it's worth the risk because Far Beyond the Stars, I mentioned this last episode, is, I think, one of the best episodes of television, period.
Agreed.
And the premise is basically that something happens to Sisko, and it frankly doesn't fucking matter. What it really happens is it's set in the 30s. I don't remember 50s. Exactly. Is it 50s? Okay.
1950s.
Sisko is playing a black science fiction author working for a magazine that is a competitor to Amazing Stories, which was the magazine published people like Asimov and and they are struggling. And he suddenly gets an inspiration to write a series of stories that are essentially the stories of Deep Space Nine. And it is actually directed by Avery Brooks. And I think you can tell because one of the things that happens is all the characters are played by actors in Deep Space Nine playing different characters. And the first thing you realize is that because all the characters are out of makeup, the deep black cast on Deep Space Nine, you don't quite realize until you see them all together. It's like there's just because Worf is also out of makeup. And Michael Dorn, who is an amazing actor, is also in that. And so you're seeing a lot of the perspective of not only the struggles of the characters, because a lot of these are metaphors for the struggles the characters are going through that they're portraying, but also simultaneously very real struggles from that time period. Now, obviously, you have much more knowledge about this from your research than I do, but I know what your thoughts about Far Beyond the Stars are.
So this episode was hard for me to watch when it first aired and when I first saw it. It is harder now for me to watch, actually, as a black writer and creative. Mm-hmm. Because you could change their clothes to our clothes, and that is the exact same struggles that I am going through in the TTRPG industry and in some other industries that I'm in. Mm-hmm. And I know that we said we weren't going to talk a lot about the TTRPG industry, but this is going to be, I guess, my first of who knows how many exceptions.
Right.
But to like see a black writer come up with something that is brilliant and have all of his fellow writers acknowledge how amazing that is, but at the same mm-hmm. time have a white publisher tell them that we can't publish your story because no one's going to believe that a black person can do this mm-hmm. is what I heard every step of the way when I was trying to have someone publish Harlem Unbound. Mm-hmm. And I heard similar things for other projects and ideas I put forward from multiple different publishers and having to do it myself. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, the character can't do that themselves in the 50s.
Right.
Like, you need them to do it for you. And mm-hmm. the unwillingness to compromise, like, make their captain white so they to be able to have their story published is devastating for a creative to have to try to be put in that situation. I know that I wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And to see then Sisko in that role saying, no, I'm not going to do that. They're like, this is a story. This is how it could be. And even when to hear him say that, like, you can pulp a story, but you can't pulp the dream. Mm-hmm. Like that, there's so much power and resonance in that.
Absolutely.
And that's not even me talking like the research side of this. It's just like my own personal experience trying to do this. And even right now with like my current book on it was that I'm working on, I'm hitting nothing but roadblocks trying to go into different avenues because I'm black. Mm-hmm.
Right. And for a sci-fi show in, at this point, 98, to just, because I mean, it's super fucking clear that this show is also working the level of the producers and people like Avery Brooks saying, I'm talking about y'all right now in the 90s, right? So the fact that you keep seeing this timelessness is heartbreaking, but also I think what the episode's going for. And it's even through that, you know, the actor who plays Quark, the fact that he's recast as a Jewish writer and the struggles that he's very briefly goes through the struggles he's going through as well. And kind of really pointing the finger, I'm like, yes, the analog of how the Ferengi and the Bajorans relate to the Cardassians are definitely relating to very real world experiences. I remember one Jewish critic talked about the fact that the Bajorans and the Ferengi are the two different Jewish stereotypes, right? And being able to take them, separate them, and then put them into contrast to each other gives you a better view of the Jewish experience, at least from an outside perspective. The show is just like the fact Deep Space Nine took risks in ways that I think a lot of the Star Trek shows couldn't do and didn't do. And sometimes those risks lead you to move along home. But sometimes they lead to this.
For instance, have Kira, who is one of the writers there, who's married to Julian, whoever his character's name is in the episode. But Kira is unable to publish under her actual name. She has to publish under a male's name. Mm-hmm. And one of the major conflicts come when to promote the magazine, they want to have a picture of all the staff so they can put that picture into the magazine. Everything goes off. And you have Kira's character says, well, I guess I'll be sick that day. And he turns to Sisko's character and basically says, I think you're going to have to stay home that day too.
Yep. And during all of this, the Irish writer actually gets a novel deal in the process, which is, I think, fair. Irish writers were coming into vogue in the 50s. They had their own struggles, but in around the 50s, they started to become very popular. So it was another sense of like, okay, well, that's pretty accurate to time from my limited understanding of sci-fi writing in the 50s. So it's working on so many levels. It's working on the pure historical level. It's working on we're learning more about the characters through their analogs level. And then also it is taking a very pointed look at, like you said, the creative industries, both then and now when it aired and today. And it's also just damn good television. I mean, it's easy to point to Avery's monologue near the end where he's so emotionally distraught. But really everyone's performance is just amazing.
We didn't even talk about Jake yet, one of the other underlying subplot that goes throughout the episode is he has his friend that he keeps meeting in the diner and saying, hey, I can help you out. Like, I'm going to become like a writer. And his friend has some, we'll say, potentially shady dealings, and you sort of slowly follow the story until that character gets killed. Mm-hmm. And the police don't care about that character. They'd already harassed Sisko just to basically threatening to bring him down to the station just so to the police station. I have to be very specific when I said that. To get a piece of artwork that he dropped that they didn't want to give him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when I rewatched this, I had forgotten about that subplot. And I was just like, wow, you know, white police officers harassing a black artist for no good damned reason. That is really relevant now. Just like, holy shit. And it's again, heartbreaking that it is still relevant now. But it goes to the quality of the team putting this show. This is a show that's very confident now of what it's doing, and the fact that it's just like, we're putting this out, and I can only imagine the fights they had to make to make this episode, and they still did, is amazing.
And for Michael Dorn's character, Worf, you have the fact that he's sort of like this famous baseball player, and you get an idea of someone that actually has money and is affluent compared to Sisko, who is poor and is just trying to make it by. Mm-hmm. He still, Worf still can't go out and do all the things that he wants to do, regardless of his money or status. Mm-hmm. He knows that if he steps out of line, he'll potentially get beaten down or killed also.
Right. But then there's also the what little standing he has in the black community of the show, he does try to leverage. So it's like, you know, oh, well, I'm a famous baseball player. You should go hang out with me. And so, like, he didn't have that power in the larger society, but within the black subculture that's developed through the course of the episode, he does try to still manage and leverage that, which is interesting, just seeing those dynamics in play.
Because it was nice to see that there is no one monolith of culture.
Mm-hmm.
And to see that displayed in the 90s on a Star Trek television show was very influential at the time, and even more so now.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me because one of the reasons why I really like genre television media, one of the reasons why I'm glad you asked me to do this with you, is that the episode itself shows you how hard it is to break through and to tell compelling stories in media in general. But if something is marginalized as media, you can take more risks. At this stage, so there was a point where, so this is a bit production side, 89, 88, Next Generation starts. It goes for 7 seasons. And then right around season 4-ish of that, Deep Space Nine starts. And so there's 2 shows on simultaneously. Then when Next Generation wraps up, they start on the UPN network, creates the Paramount network is created. And so their flagship show is Voyager. And so they kind of wrap up Next Generation, start doing Voyager. And so Deep Space Nine kind of bracketing those. So initially, there was a lot of interference in Deep Space Nine because they wanted to have Deep Space, wanted Next Generation again. And the crew very much didn't want to make that show. It's like, no, we're making something very different here. We're making something compelling here. So when Voyager came on board, a lot of the staff from Next Generation kind of moved on to Voyager so they could make that the, okay, we'll make Next Generation over here then. And they kind of just stopped paying attention to Deep Space Nine. And so right around that point is when a lot of fans call it, when losing the hair, when Avery Brooks shaves his head, that's really kind of where the tone shifts, because at that point in time, Paramount's like, okay, you know what? We've got our Next Generation successor now over here. We don't need you to be that anymore. And they're like, great, so we can just start doing stuff. And so when that pressure is off, when it needs to stop being relevant to culture as a whole, it actually starts becoming more relevant to culture as a whole. When the interference is off, genre media has the room to do things that popular media can't always do. And I find that fascinating, because sometimes you see shows get right up to the line and stop. And sometimes shows just jump right out of that line and don't care. Doctor Who constantly straddles this line because it is an institution of British television, but there are points where it was not very popular. And when it was not very popular, at times it becomes its most compelling and interesting because it's trying things that it wouldn't do when it was a bastion of British television.
It took a lot of big swings and had a lot of misses.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And again, Deep Space Nine doesn't always hit. But, you know, at the same time, like I mentioned, the first few seasons, it's very compartmentalized. Even season 6, obviously, the fact that we can pull this episode out is not common for serialized television. But season 7 is basically one big long story. You pretty much have to watch that from start to finish, because at that point, it's like, this is our final season. We can take this structural risk.
But also, here, though, it was kind of like a chess game at that point, though. You had all your parts moving for the first 6 seasons, and then you've moved in basically for the kill. And you have nothing left but those final moves to the end of the game.
Right. And when you're deep in season 6 and you know season 7 is going to happen and it's going to be important, you can have someone, Avery Brooks, say, cool, I want to make this. If you want to keep me on board, let me make this. And something that can then exist. Because I know one thing that Avery Brooks said in interviews is that one of the things that really drew him to the role was the idea of a positive portrayal of a black father. And that's something he's very passionate about. And so you see a lot more room given to Sisko's relationship with Jake than I think any other show would have done. And the show is better for it as a result.
I can tell you, I have I did not see a lot of those growing up, and I still haven't seen a lot of them now.
Mm-hmm.
And the rarity of that is unbelievable, as there are so many amazing black fathers.
Right.
Being a black father myself, that's incredibly
important.
What's that?
You would know.
To me.
And so that's why it's so. So again, for context, and we've talked before that the show is going to be about us to a degree, and I think that's important for us to show. I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood, and so while I could never speak to the same experiences that Chris has, I certainly felt on some level a frustration of, why can't I see my friends on screen? So when I saw Deep Space Nine, I was like, oh, finally. I was like, this is the kind of stuff I want to see my friends in. You know, I want to see characters like this more. I started to apply it to myself much later in life. And that's one of the reasons why I'm going to do a spinoff thing we'll talk about later related to that. But disability representation is also garbage. Mm-hmm. But seeing stuff like this, it's I love it because it's not black television. It's just television that also happens to center this experience. So like, you could show this to anybody and it's like, it's just damn good gripping drama for an hour. The fact that it also has these layers makes it even better, but it's not the reason for it to exist. It is something, and it does not feel out of place for this show, because this is also a show where they have an entire episode about playing baseball with Vulcans. Okay. So I mean, like, this is not a stretch of the imagination for this show. This show does some, there's an entire episode where the Ferengi go back in time and are responsible for Area 51 because they're part of the original UFOs found by the Air Force in the 60s. This show that recognizes it could do some out there things and doesn't have a problem with it, because Star Trek can do some out there things. And the fact that they said, cool, but we want to make sure we do this thing. And the fact that they spent that capital to make this exist is just amazing. And the fact that this is not only a single episode, but if you go through the whole show, there's smaller examples of this kind of thing. It has one of, if not the first lesbian kiss on national television. And they got hate mail for it. They got hate mail for this episode. This episode and the episode where Dax kisses her wife were both preempted in some southern markets initially. So, I mean, there was backlash for this, and they kept doing it. That's amazing. So sometimes even the behind-the-scenes stuff of these shows are just as impressive as the actual show. But again,
frequently more so.
Yeah, but still, this is just, again, it's just damn good television. I mean, you know, here's four episodes of this sci-fi show about aliens with bumpy foreheads, and we have an examination of how you cope with being a part of an evil regime, how much you balance your secret life and your desire to be home with the lives of your friends and their secrets, and the black creative experience. And this is just four episodes. And so it's like, obviously not every episode like could be great, but it hits more than it misses.
So I guess to date us, the timing of us doing this and from what happened in the real world right now is just something I feel that I have to mention, because we just recently had the passing of Sidney Poitier,
mm-hmm.
who was a phenomenal actor that every actor and I think every creative and every person owes an enormous thank you and boon to, and whose work revolutionized movies and television.
Absolutely.
And he'll be greatly missed.
I completely agree. I read that like right before we recorded, and I was like, oh man. But he had a full life and he did so much to push the art forward, frankly. And it's nice to see, sometimes people like Avery Brooks don't get the same kind of recognition for doing that in genre spaces. Sadly, I'm blanking on Kara's actress name, but she did very similar things for women's roles in sci-fi space.
Nina Visitor, is that it?
Yeah, thank you, Nina Visitor, right.
Or Nana Visitor. Nina, sorry if I mispronounced it.
Right. As you can tell, we don't research these very heavily. but
it just wouldn't be us talking if we did actual work for it.
Amazing, right? But she did similar things when she got the Kira role. She's like, I'm not going to be sexy. I'm not going to, I want this to be a real character. And so she pushed for things like the short haircut that she has, you know, and for a lot of the body language she uses is very different from traditional quote unquote female body language in these kinds of sci-fi shows. And so, I mean, it's easy to point to Avery to a certain degree because he's playing the lead, but a lot of the actors were doing this level. Again, the actor who played Quark did a really good job to work to soften the stereotype of the Ferengi to make them a more well-rounded race because he himself was Jewish. So he was like, I know what this is trying to do. I'm taking on this role because I think there's more here that we can then add layers to because we're seeing his because character a lot.
The previous portrayal of the Ferengi was horrible.
Oh, so bad.
That was some offensive stuff.
Yeah, and it weirdly did not get better. Really, Deep Space Nine is the only place that had a really good portrayal of them. And even then, it was rocky to start. But Quark did a ton. And then I watched a documentary about this. He actually would then train all the other Ferengi actors. They actually had like a little Ferengi acting camp where he would tell, okay,
that's awesome.
Not that. Yeah, no, he made sure it was all consistent. He wasn't paid for that. He just felt that strongly about it. So yeah, Deep Space Nine. I'm not even going to ask you to rank the captains at this stage because I think we both know the answer is going to be.
You know what? I think you might be surprised. I think we have to rank the captain. That's going to be our shtick. I think every season we'll have a shtick, and this is going to be our shtick for sci-fi fantasy.
So we have Kirk, we have Pike, we have Sheridan, and we have Sinclair, and now we have Sisko, who is the captain at the end, so he counts.
So do you want to go first?
No, you go first. I did last.
Oh. Curses. So this is going to probably surprise a lot of people.
Okay.
But my first choice for captain, and it's just by like a fraction of a fraction of a hair, is going to be Sheridan.
Really? Really? Tell me why.
Because my big thing is that arc that the character goes through, and mm-hmm. getting to see Sheridan go from like that spunky space hero to grizzled veteran captain to diplomat is an incredible transformation to watch, and to know that you have a very finite amount of time that you find out in the show in the work that he needs to accomplish, and dedicating himself and his family dedicates themselves and everyone else to try to accomplish this thing that is insurmountable is amazing to see. And that is why he's like barely beats Sisko, who I think Sisko is an incredible captain who does something that very few other captains do, mm-hmm. which is have faith in your subordinates, like the people that are working for you, to put faith in them and trust them. Like throughout the episodes that we watched today, if someone said, even in Duet, where Kira was too close to the situation and Sisko says, I'm going to have Odo do this instead.
Yep.
She came to him and said, I promise you, as your first officer, I can be neutral towards this and make it for justice and not vengeance. And him mm-hmm. saying, I believe you, go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like that is trust in your people that work for you.
Yes.
And that is how you build loyalty. That's how you build an exceptional team and a community to succeed. And while I love Sheridan and he's still my first pick, Sheridan couldn't do that, which right. is one of the reasons why if you watch the show, you'll see some close allies aren't always allies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll leave it like that without spoilers.
Yeah. He I don't want to say micromanages, but he gets close to that. So for after, me, actually let's go through the rest. So after those two, is it still the same?
Yeah, you got Pike, mm-hmm. Sinclair, Kirk.
Right. Okay. I think I'm in the same boat for the last three. I would flip the first two because for me, the one piece I think puts Sisko a little bit over is he's doing a lot of what Sheridan is doing. And on top of that, is also a literal Christ figure for the Bajorans. He is a prominent religious figure for their faith. And takes that seriously because it's so easy for a character in this position, and we've seen it in a lot of sci-fi shows. It's the, oh, look, the natives think that I'm a god. That's cute. I'm going to, you know, kind of belittle that because they're backwards weirdos. But he doesn't. He's like, okay, you believe me to be this person. I want to try to respect your beliefs while recognizing that I am a flawed man and I have to, and it's more deeply flawed. I mean, the quote I read is near like season six. He's done some horrible things during the course of the awful things that happened in the last few seasons. And still near the end, manages to embody that object of faith in a respectful way. And that is hard to do. So I give him a little bit extra because he's got an additional level of complexity on top of everything else that I think Sheridan doesn't quite have to deal with. But I do agree that Sheridan has, again, it's fractions because Sheridan's arc isn't just an arc. It goes through a few different permutations. It's not just a simple kind of A, B, C done. It's, you know, you say it changes two or three times through the show, which Sisko does not quite do. Sisko very much as he starts off as a traumatized man, ends up as someone who's finally comfortable with himself and his newfound family. So that's a pretty clear, obvious arc, and it's an amazing, compelling arc, but it is one arc where Sheridan does have, he becomes a new character, and then that character also goes through a separate growth. So he had kind of has two arcs, which is amazing too. So it's really rough.
I totally agree with you for Sisko, but Sheridan is still my fraction, but I will be remiss if I didn't point out, because technically, you like that? I even pushed my glasses up on my nose. So I'm wearing my glasses this morning. technically, Sheridan is also a Christ-like figure who literally, all right, people, if you don't want to hear a spoiler, I would suggest that you stop listening right now, 3, 2, 5, 4, 2, 1, right now, dies and comes back. It is honored as such.
You're right. I forgot about that. Shit.
But unlike Sisko, who takes it seriously, does everything he can, Sheridan kind of uses that as a weapon.
Right. Right. He does.
If you're waiting for the spoiler to end, the spoiler, I think, has officially ended.
Right. I'll put timestamps in the show notes so people can zip past it. I still feel like Sisko's just over the edge to me. But again, we're talking like I would happily put them at the top of their own separate lists, you know? And I think it's a really hard choice. And they're both amazing characters and they're both amazing shows. At the end of the day, I think it's what we're learning from looking at Babylon 5, Deep Space Nine. There's a lot of similarities, not just darn space stations. There's a lot of things you can point to. Yeah, there's a war, there's conflicts between species, there's a leading character with a compelling arc, but they're also very, very different. They're doing very different things in those spaces. So, do you have any final thoughts on Deep Space Nine?
Deep Space Nine is probably one of my all-time favorite science fiction television shows to date.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad we got to talk about it.
And I want a reboot of Deep Space Nine.
That would be amazing. There's been some vague talk about that. That and also a season 8, possibly.
That'd be interesting. Which
would be weird to do, but I'd be curious. But something with this structure would be fun. I will say, if people like this kind of space station with a morally complex Federation and lots of intrigue, there is a series of Star Trek novels called the Vanguard series. There's 9 of them. I just wrapped up. And it's set in the original series, but it's the same very rough premise. It's a Space Station 47, and they're on the edge of unexplored space between the Klingons and the Tholians. And there's shenanigans involved. There's Starfleet intelligence involved. Some characters lie to each other. Some characters die. So if you like this kind of dynamic, it's very different character cast, but the Vanguard novel series is a pretty good way to kind of get scratch that itch if you're interested.
Cool. I'm on after because I have to check those out.
Yeah. They're all on ebooks. So you can pick them up, like, you know, just read them in ebook or I think the story being reprinted. So they only start coming out like 10, 15 years ago. So they're still pretty recent. Next episode, we're going to talk about Dark Matter. So Chris, which episodes are we going to watch for that?
So Dark Matter is up next, and it's a show that I watched once when it aired. So it'll be a fun discussion as we all try to remember everything about it. But we're going to start season 1, episodes 1 and 2, season 2, episode 13, But first, we save the galaxy and finishing it off with season 3, episode 9. Isn't that a paradox?
And I have seen exactly zero of this show. So this first one I'm coming into fresh. I'm excited for that. And also, related to this, I think it'll probably be coming out after this episode. Timing works out. But Chris and I talked. We're also going to do occasionally things where one of us wants to dig into a piece of media a little more deeply. So rather than forcing our colleagues to watch or read a bunch of stuff, we'll kind of just do some solo episodes. And I'm going to start that off. I'm going to do a run, I'm tentatively calling Speechless, but it's going to be on the Matt Fraction Hawkeye run from 2012. Because as someone with hearing loss, that run means a whole lot to me. And especially because it was the basis for the recent Disney Plus show. So I think I really want to sit down and talk about each of the issues, what's going on in those issues. It's going to be a lot of me just going, this is amazing. But also there's some things that are – there's a certain issue of that run that I cried because I finally saw myself in a comic in a way I had not seen before. So it means a lot to me personally, and it's something I've been wanting to talk about for a while. So I'm going to take some space. It'll be interlaced between the other episodes. I think I've planned out for a 6-episode run of that. And then when this season wraps up and that season wraps up, we'll figure out what we're doing after that. We're still discussing options. But so you'll be getting more of this pretty soon. But in the meantime, Chris, if people wanted to chat with you online, where would they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @darker_hue, or you can always send me an email. Or if you're really, really lucky, and I mean super lucky, I may be in my Discord that you could pop into where there are other people that are talking all the time about super awesome stuff.
Yeah, actually, I just recently joined the Darker Hue Discord. And actually, it's a pretty fun place to hang out. I've been really enjoying hanging out in that space. So, yeah, you could probably find both of us there these days as you're listening to this. You can find me at pugsteady.com. You can also find me on Twitter at pugsteady. Until then, we'll talk to you in 1 week about Hawkeye and in 2 weeks about Dark Matter. See you then.
Take care.